Welcome back, everyone. We've made it to the end of the week. It's gone by quickly. I hope you've had some good times in these sessions. I also hope you've had some good times out of these sessions. Gotten a chance to get some trees in. Otherwise, it's going to be a rough hike to Heart Lake this afternoon tonight. I hope you will. So it's been a great week, and just thank you again to all of you who have been here, dropping in throughout the week. It's really been a pleasure to be here, a great first Holden experience for me and my family. So today we're going to just finish up with a couple of slides I didn't get to on Baldwin, a couple of things I wanted to pick up from yesterday. Then we're going to move into just a brief reflection on the work of a more contemporary author, a man named Ta-Nehisi Coates. Okay? So where I left us yesterday, I'm going to stop doing the recap for the whole week because it's getting, we're at the end now, so just jump on, here we go. Yesterday we were looking at the end of our time together at the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. And I was saying that one of the things that I really appreciate about Baldwin is his emphasis on just how difficult and important telling the truth can be. What sort of a subversive act just sort of recognizing and digging into the truth can be. And I think the same thing can happen when we dig into the texts, the biblical texts, with a similar kind of subversive eye, a similar kind of persistent demand to tell the truth. And so I commended to folks the work of William Herzog, who is a biblical scholar who tries to get us to see that the parables that Jesus is telling, again, aren't stories that are supposed to make us find the God character and find the sort of spiritual nugget of truth, even though they can be used for that, used for different means. But in their core, at their heart, these are stories that are trying to get people to see anew the realities of their world, right? And for Jesus, that is a sort of a spiritual theological exercise. Right? That is just as spiritual, just as meaningful, trying to figure out what the text says to me about my personal relationship with Jesus. Knowing what your relationship is with the economy, with the political system, with your neighbors, this is equally a theological and political task. Okay, so again, we can talk more about that afterwards if you weren't here or have any questions about that. So to finish up with Baldwin, a couple of comments. This is one of my more kind of eclectic presentations. So this whole week has been, actually. So people sort of ask me what my research is in. My research is primarily in Martin Luther, Reformation theology, and kind of the reception of various thinkers in Christian ethics and philosophical ethics. And so that's what I do my academic hardcore stuff in. But I also have a real passion for critical race theory, racism, identity issues, social justice. And so you get sort of this eclectic mix of those things this week, I think. But then I always have a bit of a challenge doing that sometimes. I'm like, well, what's the natural connection between James Baldwin and Martin Luther?
Yeah.
There is not one. To the best of my knowledge, Baldwin never read any of Luther's stuff. He wasn't digging into the 55 volumes of the American edition during his free time. And to the best of my knowledge, Martin Luther wasn't a time traveler, so we also didn't know James Baldwin. So no organic connection. The one thing I was happy to find one time was this little piece. So at one point while he's living in Paris, he gets an assignment from a magazine to go do a little interview, a little profile of the Scandinavian film director Ingmar Bergman, right? Seventh Seal, other kinds of movies like this. And so he had a real respect for Bergman. He had seen all of his films. He went and interviewed him. And based on his interview, he had these comments to make. So he says, Baldwin says, "All art is a kind of confession, more or less oblique. All artists, if they are to survive, are forced at last to tell the whole story, to vomit the anguish up. All of it, the literal and the fanciful." Bergman's authority seemed, then, to come from the fact that he was reconciled to this arduous, delicate, and disciplined self-exposure. Just love Baldwin's writing. Wish I could write that well. Right? I love that phrase. Arduous, delicate, and disciplined self-exposure. Okay? Not just sort of, exposing yourself willy-nilly. That didn't sound right. Work on the phrasing there. You get that. Moving along. Right? But not just sort of, again, sometimes I feel like this is a lesson we got when I was back in seminary a few years ago. That sometimes when pastors are in the pulpit, there's a tendency to want to be vulnerable with your congregation, and that's important. But sometimes that vulnerability puts the congregation in a difficult position where now they're trying to care for you. And if you keep returning to like the same issue over and over again, with your own doubts or fears, there can be a way that you can do that that kind of shifts the pastoral congregational role, right? Just like you want to be vulnerable in front of your children, right? But you don't invite them in and say, listen, you know, listen, Austin, we've got some real financial problems, right? Times are tough. I got this growth that I'm not sure what's going on. I feel a lot better. Like, you know, thanks. Go have fun at Narnia this morning. I'll pick you up. Right? So there are different ways to be vulnerable, okay? And Baldwin, again, this arduous, delicate, disciplined self-exposure is what he's calling for as his task as an author, as a task as an artist, and I think our task as Christians. I want to just take everything he says about being an author and make it about being a Christian, or about being a human, honestly, more broadly construed. So, final thing here, one thing I like. This essay in which Baldwin is writing about Bergman, giving this profile, visiting his shop, meeting his crew, all that kind of stuff, he titles it The Northern Protestant. Which to me is essentially the Lutheran. Right? So this is his reflection on what it means, what this vision of Christianity that he's getting through these Scandinavian artists and these Scandinavian people that he's meeting. Okay? And he finds another quote I didn't include. He finds this nice, oh, there it is. I wrote it right here. He says, Baldwin says, I thought how there was something in the weird, mad Northern Protestantism which reminded me of the visions of the black preachers of my childhood. End quote. I love this. Partly because it's praising the Lutheran Church, or Lutherans, but partly because I don't recognize this in a lot of the Lutherans that I see and meet. Right, so it seems that Baldwin has captured some moment in Lutheran identity, in sort of this cultural milieu of Northern Protestantism that makes Protestantism makes Lutheranism seem weird, strange, confrontational, dedicated to exposing what, like our flaws and our vulnerabilities, and exposing just the quotidian muck of human life. And so I would like to see more of us do that in ways that are just as arduous, just as beautiful, and just as necessary. By and large, though, Baldwin didn't have the best relationship with religious people, or particularly the Christian church in the United States. Okay. So this is, again, from The Fire Next Time. This is from My Dungeon Shook. Baldwin says, the white man's heaven, sings a black minister's black Muslim minister, is the black man's hell. One may object, possibly, that this puts the matter somewhat too simply. But the song is true. And it has been true for as long as white men have ruled the world. It goes on to say, if the concept of God has any validity or any use, it can only make us larger, freer, and more loving. If God cannot do this, then it is time we got rid of him.
Right? That's a challenge.
He's throwing down the gauntlet, right? If your God isn't making you and your community in this world a better place, then you need to get rid of that. Okay. Now, theologians might come at this a little bit differently, right? And say that the reason that people's God isn't making them more loving, larger, freer, is because they're not actually worshiping God but some kind of idol they've constructed, some kind of false image of God. But I like just the harsh, confrontational, clear-cut way that Baldwin puts it here. Right? If God isn't making you these things, then we got to leave God by the side of the road. Now, Baldwin's approach to religion in his own life was a little bit complicated. As I said yesterday, he grew up the son of a Baptist preacher, was a Pentecostal sort of storefront church preacher around 14 or so, got deeply involved in that movement, then left the church completely, and was pressed throughout his life to kind of explain his stance and relationship to Christianity. And he always was very cagey about it in a way that I actually really love. He's like, well, I'm not going anywhere right now, right, was kind of his answer. You know, I'm doing okay without that. But he never denounced Christianity as a whole, and he constantly used kind of biblical allusions and images and stuff from spirituals and his own experience throughout his work, was always close to Dr. King and other folks, strong Christian leaders in the civil rights movement. And so, again, I love the way that he sort of stands on the edge of the Christian community. But he's not going to be thrown out of it. But he's not going to come much closer until Christians can show that they're creating a place where people with his color skin are going to be welcome and invited to be closer. So a lesson for us all. What I take from the lesson is I wonder how many sort of brilliant Baldwins there are out there, kind of on the periphery, who aren't being welcomed or being made welcome in our communities, Christian or otherwise. Okay. But I think, and this is the passage I picked for last night, so you might have heard this already last night, Vespers. But I think Baldwin's message resonates for me with what the author of 1 John says. Right? God is love. Right? Love is imperfected among us in this, that we may have boldness on the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in the world. Right? Now, we could read the day of judgment as being some sort of eschatological day we go meet Jesus in heaven, that kind of thing. That's one way to read it. You could read it as today. Right? You could consider every day a day of judgment, a day where you're questioned and asked, you know, am I being in the world the way that God is being in the world? Okay. And of course, what people often lop off, sometimes people like stop right here and they don't go on to the next part. Right? So we love because he first loved us, which I've heard many Christian songs sort of based on. But the passage goes on, right? And John says, those who say I love God and hate their brothers or sisters are liars. For those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. The commandment we have from him is this: those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also. Okay? So again, truth and honesty. Right? Are we honestly loving God, or are we honestly loving each other? If not, we're a liar, or our God is false. All right, I can move on from Baldwin. Doing that thing I do where I spill over one day into the other. So if you're curious, a couple of things I've mentioned already. Some of Baldwin's text, if you want to follow up. Most of the stuff I did from yesterday and today came from The Fire Next Time with a few other essays thrown in there. Copies of that can be found in any bookstore, any library. There's also this nice little collection called Collected Essays, which includes the text from The Fire Next Time and a bunch of other things. Has very thin kind of like Bible paper, so there's a lot of stuff in there, but if you're looking for just a bigger chunk of texts. But if you're just, you just want to get your feet wet and want to get a good taste of Baldwin, you would not do wrong to just pick up The Fire Next Time, probably get it for a couple bucks on Amazon used or your local Powell's or bookstore and just walking out the door. Okay. Also, for those of you who like watching movies, like myself, there's this wonderful documentary that came out 2 years ago. Yeah. Called I Am Not Your Negro. It's a documentary about Baldwin. The documentary is based on the text from an unfinished novel that Baldwin had. Like many of us who are writers, he was a little behind. So he was like, got this contract to do this novel, got like a nice big advance. And like 18 years later, the novel still hadn't materialized, so I feel okay about my deadlines. And but what happened was the unfinished pages of that novel this director took and sort of used them as a voiceover in this documentary that takes historical images, so images of Baldwin and others, Malcolm X and Martin and all these folks around him, all these folks from that time, and then often juxtaposes that with images from today. Right? So you'll have, for example, a picture from Birmingham, you know, with Bull Connor and folks out there charging the black protesters, and it will shift to Ferguson or shift to Oakland or shift to somewhere else. Okay, trying to kind of make us aware of the resonance both the issues and the words have. It's also the narration is done by Samuel L. Jackson, which I think is a great voice to kind of stand in for James Baldwin. So I like it for a number of reasons. It's on Amazon Prime. If I'm addicted to Amazon Prime, I have to admit it. For all my justice concerns, I have this weird, like, I also want packages to show up in 2 days. So I've been conditioned. But anyway, it's on Amazon Prime for free if you want to just click over there. If you're not into that, borrow your friend's password or something. Okay. All right, so today we're going to finish up our conversation this week looking at a contemporary author, Ta-Nehisi Coates, or Ta-Nehisi Coates. I've always heard it said Ta-Nehisi, but do your best. He's not in the room. If he ever comes to Holden, let me know. I'll be right behind him. Okay. Nope. I'm skipping that. Yep, skipping that too. Okay. Gotta move on. So this is Ta-Nehisi Coates. Young African-American man. Young by, I mean, like my age-ish. I'm still calling myself young, so we're gonna go with that. Grew up in Baltimore. Went to Howard University. Spent a bulk of his life now in and around New York City with his wife and son. Ta-Nehisi sort of blew up on the scene a couple of years ago with this cover article that was in The Atlantic. It's a little fuzzy. But the title of the article is simply The Case for Reparations. Okay. Now, who knows what reparations are? Okay, can someone tell us? What do you got there?
Paying back for what we did to African Americans who were enslaved in our country or Native Americans.
Exactly. Right. So coming to truth with our history, coming to terms with our history, means acknowledging that the wealth of the nation was built on the backs of free labor, exploited labor, enslaved labor. But the land that they labored on was taken from other brown folks. And so the idea behind reparations is to make amends, some sort of issue of justice for that exploited labor and its effects. So when most people saw this title and looked at the article, there was sort of a hot debate about, well, you know, reparations, you know, how's that really going to work? You know, these slaves lived all these years ago, et cetera, et cetera. Those are my great-great-great-great-grandparents, or like, I was an Irish immigrant, I wasn't even here yet, yada, yada, yada. Okay, all that kind of stuff. What's interesting is if you actually read the article, Ta-Nehisi doesn't focus as much on slavery as he does on more contemporary issues. Right? So he says, yes, slavery was certainly a huge issue that again, exploited and all this labor from individuals. He has some nice little stories of women and men and their experiences in the South and elsewhere. But he says, you also don't have to go back that far in time. Right. So this is a map that is an example of redlining. I changed it up for you all. I usually use Chicago. This is Seattle. Right. A few of you are from the Seattle area, I understand. Okay. You can find it on a map, hopefully. Right. Who knows what redlining is? Let's go in the back. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was the practice of not allowing people who wanted to purchase homes in a particular neighborhood, African American people or people of Asian descent that couldn't homes in that particular neighborhood that was safe for white folks.
Exactly.
It was actually mine drawn.
Yeah.
Seattle, it included Jewish people, too.
Excellent. Yeah, okay. So Jewish, Asian descents, probably indigenous folks, African Americans, all people of various shades were included. And there were different zones on the map. You could see the map listed at your mortgage officer's, you know, kiosk or inside their little cubicle. The federal government helped enforce this and create these maps. And what happens is that folks who live in the red areas can't get mortgages to purchase their homes, and or the value of their homes is locked at such a low level that they never get any equity. Right? So you might own a home, you might have bought it for $20,000, and 20 years later, it's worth $22,000, or that sort of thing. Whereas folks nowadays tend to expect their home to be an investment in suburban areas and elsewhere. They're going to pump money into it and then milk it all out until the economy tanks.
What years was this enforced?
It was throughout the middle of the 20th century, so kind of 1946 to 1960s, late 60s.
The GI Bill was a huge thing with this.
Exactly, and that's another part of Ta-Nehisi talks about the GI Bill as well, right? And says that if you look at who got access to all of these loans that the government was helping to support, and the system they were doing, it was all the white GIs returning and then their children after them. If you looked at who got access to the GI Bill for college education, right, it was white GIs and their children. Yes?
There's a book that's called When Affirmative Action Was White that I'm going to talk about.
Right. Yeah, we tend to frame affirmative action or kind of subsidized programs with a very narrow lens. It includes aid for women with children and welfare kinds of operations, and miss the fact that most of the country was propped up by federal aid. Most of the white country was propped up by federal aid to get education, to buy houses, to have mortgages, all that kind of stuff. Okay, and so part of Ta-Nehisi's argument then is that this created just a huge middle class. Right, we all know this. The economics on this are clear. The middle class exploded. The middle class was predominantly white. And that meant that blacks were locked out of wealth creation for several generations and still are today in many ways. Okay? So again, what Ta-Nehisi is trying to do then is shift the conversation and say, listen, if you want to talk about reparations for, you know, hundreds of years of slavery, you can just go back into your own lifetime. Like, I'll meet you halfway, I'll meet you most of the way, and let's just talk about what's happened in the last 60, 70 years. Okay. The situation hasn't changed much. It goes to 2013. When we look at what happened in the United States after the sort of the big crash in 07, 08, the data shows that everyone went down, right? Lots of folks were underwater, lots of folks across the board lost money. But a couple years later, white families started to tick back up again, and black families continued down the spiral, right? The downward trajectory. So based on, again, this is a couple of years old, but some of the older data, by the year, 2031, black households will have 22% of the wealth of white households. So again, part of Ta-Nehisi's argument is he's trying to get us to reckon with our history as a nation, and not even our ancient history. Just our contemporary modern history, our present realities. Okay, so it was the work in this book on this article on reparations that sort of a few years ago put Ta-Nehisi in everyone's eye. And then he followed up with this book, a book called Between the World and Me, in two parts. The book is styled as a letter to his son. Coates explicitly is copying Baldwin. Like I said, the first part of Fire Next Time is this letter Baldwin writes to his nephew. Although Coates owned up in an interview I saw one time when someone was like, so what is it like to give this to your son, to write this for your son? And he's like, oh, that was just like a literary device. it's a book. Like, I talked to my son, but I didn't like write this thing out on, like, by hand and like hand it to him. But he wants to sort of mimic Baldwin's style. Why? Because, again, it's partly autobiographical. It partly gives him a chance to sort of reflect on his own life and think about what he wants to hand on to the next generation, to kind of dig deeper and wrestle with what his life has been like and how he sees the United States today. So, what does Coates say? Well, similar to Baldwin, he's very critical of the American project. So he says this. The American people, he's commenting here on sort of the violence and brutality in American history. Right, what we've done to indigenous peoples, what we've done to black and brown folks repeatedly and are still doing. He says, related to all this violence, the American people are not original in this. But this banality of violence can never excuse America, because America makes no claim to the banal. American believes itself exceptional, the greatest and noblest nation ever to exist, a lone champion standing between the white city of democracy and the terrorists, despots, and barbarians, and other enemies of civilization. One cannot at once claim to be superhuman and then plead mortal error. I propose to take our countrymen's claims of American exceptionalism seriously, which is to say, I propose subjecting our country to an exceptional moral standard. This is difficult because there exists all around us an apparatus urging us to accept American innocence at face value and not to inquire too much. Okay. I love all of this. Where's the... My little laser pointer's gone. Well, there. I'll just wave this remote at it. But the line there, that second half of that first sentence, right? I propose to take our countrymen's claims of American exceptionalism seriously, which is to say I propose subjecting our country to an exceptional moral standard. Right? I love that. We hear a lot about making America great again, right? A lot about getting back to the way things used to be, this kind of repristinated image of the past. And I love how Coates flips this, right? He's like, I'll go with, you know, he's writing before Trump, before 2016, what have you. But he's still saying, you know, let's say if you're going to make America great, he's like, good, I'm going to hold you to that, right? And greatness means reckoning with our claims to moral superiority by actually being morally superior, right? By actually being better than we were or have been.
Superior to
Right. Yeah, being superior in the sense of being better than you were and being as good as you think you are. Right? It's a little dated now, but there was that one Fox commentator. I don't remember their names. But it was one of them. It was a white guy with brown hair.
Tucker Carlson.
Yeah, whatever. Tucker Andy, Carl O'Flanagan, whatever. I saw it through like Colbert because I wasn't actually watching him, but it was like one of these things where he was going on and on about, you know, America, the greatest, best, most wonderful, excellent nation in the world. It was like this never-ending string of adjectives that like any English professor would have been like, you need to break this up, right? But it was like this desire to list this litany of American greatness by listing all these adjectives, right? Whereas I think Coates says, instead of just saying all the words that equal greatness, you know, actually live lives and show how you're being great in the world. Right? How it is are you leading here and abroad? Okay? All right. One of the terms that Coates uses a lot in his writing, in Between the World and Me, is he has this phrase called the dream, capital T, capital D. Right? And you'll recognize it as sort of the American dream. He says, you know, the dream is here to distract us from recognizing reality. The dream gets pumped at us. You know, the 2.5 children, the white picket fence. My family is always posing in suits, sitting on fence. Yeah. It's pretty standard, really. The smiling, happy, sort of quasi-multicultural picture of children at Disney. Right, here we all get along. Here we all buy princess dresses. We're all going to have barbecues and neighborhoods and all get together. Okay. What Coates criticizes about all of these images is the effect it had on him growing up as a poor man in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Right? He said he would watch TV, he would read magazines, he would see these things, and he's wondering, like, what planet are these images coming from? Right? What are these lives like? And then his teachers and the people in institutional power would say, if you go to school, if you try hard, you're going to achieve this dream. And he's like, that hasn't happened for anyone in my neighborhood, right? Yeah. My brothers, my cousins, my aunties, my uncles, like no one has reached this. We don't, I'm sure we want to. So again, the image of trying to create the perfect life, the perfect America that fits this very homogeneous, very consumer-driven image, right? He describes sort of witnessing this as a child and just being aware of the gap that created between his life, his community, and what America was supposed to be. He really describes it as a sort of alien experience. Like it felt like he was on a different planet and all this was happening somewhere else. Okay. Coates goes on to say this. Oftentimes when these conversations and challenges are raised, people will fall back into the language of intention, right? Well, I mean, I was just trying to create some wealth for my family, take care of my kids. I just wanted the best school for my kids. I didn't mean anything. I didn't mean any harm to black or brown or other people anywhere. Just trying to, you know, do good things. And so Coates says this. The point of this language of intention and personal responsibility is broad exoneration. Mistakes were made. Bodies were broken. People were enslaved. We meant well. We tried our best. Good intention is the hall pass through history, a sleeping pill that ensures the dream. So Coates is trying to push us beyond very limited conceptions of responsibility that stop with individual intention and culpability, right? And get us to see, much like King and Baldwin as well, that we're woven together in a much bigger garment than we realize, that we've reaped all kinds of benefits from folks who were before us, folks who worked hard and folks who worked good, and folks who didn't work as hard and folks who worked for evil, right? All of that's in the mix. And so we can't simply shrug off the effects based on claims of our own personal intentions or even the intentions of our dear beloved grandma and grandpa. All right. God rest their soul. All right? So Coates, as I said, writes very poignantly about his experience growing up in Baltimore. It doesn't sound like a great experience. He grows up in a poor neighborhood, in a neighborhood riddled with violence. Other black kids beating up him and other kids, having to remain tough on the streets, the police, a constant presence kind of prowling the neighborhood. And he says this, "To be black in the Baltimore of my youth was to be naked before the elements of the world, before all the guns, to be fists, I can't type, knives, crack, rape, and disease. The nakedness is not an error, nor a pathology. The nakedness is the correct and intended result of policy, the predictable upshot of people forced for centuries to live under fear." So what I think is also great about Coates's writing, if you have a chance to pick up his work, I hope you'll do, is that he also wants to get at what the institutional effects of racism and violence have been on the black psyche in the neighborhood that he can speak about and experience, right? He has these stories of, you know, walking back from the, you know, candy store, kind of always keeping your head on a swivel, right? Always kind of being on the lookout. He says, you know that if somebody says, "Hey, bro, nice bike," they're not really offering you a compliment, right? And you start pedaling a little bit faster. He describes the way that his parents would be very forceful and disciplining him very hard, right? Spankings and tough rules and that kind of stuff. He said in part because they wanted to make sure that he didn't get hurt out there by other people or by the police. Right? So they'd be tougher on him to make him tougher and protect him from the world. And he says people tend to write this off as just sort of the side effects of drugs or the side effects of gang violence or the side effects of poverty. But he's trying to say, no, these aren't side effects. Right? This is intentional. Right? In order to control wealth and keep it in a certain population, other folks have to not have wealth. And have to be poor, right? You're trying to keep crime in one area, okay? Trying to sort of protect yourself, at least give yourself the illusion of protection. This is something that I was resonating with when I was hearing the talk last night, which where she went, okay, about, can't see the light. Is she here, Jennifer? No. Okay.
Yeah.
No.
In the corner.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought I saw you, then I couldn't tell. The talk last night in this very room where we were looking at questions of convicted sex offenders and what's happened after they've served their time and are they going to be integrated into communities and into society and sort of what a failure the attempt has been to kind of isolate them and detain them sort of Gitmo style indefinitely, right? There's this desire to sort of create pockets where we feel like we're safe. Certain people feel like they're safe and sort of push what we think are dangerous things or dangerous people into other places, into other pockets, right? And so I think Coates is commenting on what happens to a community when it lives under fear, generation after generation. Okay? All right. So Coates is an excellent and powerful writer who talks deeply and powerfully about his experience and one vision of the black experience in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and today. He, also like Baldwin, is a critic of religion, a critic of Christianity, but even a deeper or more ambivalent critic than Baldwin. So Coates himself didn't grow up in a religious home. It wasn't a part of his upbringing. And he describes the church interesting in a couple of interesting ways. He says people in church are watching and reveling in a specious hope. Kind of a pie in the sky, by and by analysis of what's going on in churches. Later on, he says, "I could not retreat as so many into the church and its mysteries. I had no sense that any just God was on my side." Okay. So, two things there. The church is a place of retreat. How many of you have heard or thought that the church should be a refuge? Yeah. You hear that message sometimes, right? The church is a place where we welcome folks in for rest, right? To recover, to sort of create a space where folks just kind of can come and to be, right? And that sounds nice if you're picturing folks who have been sort of beaten down or folks who have been excluded or folks who have been harassed and harangued in various ways out in the world. Coates' sense is that the church is often a retreat for folks who probably aren't being all that harassed and harangued, right? folks who have benefited from education and wealth and other opportunities, who aren't afraid for violence against their bodies, but still kind of want a place to put up their feet, right? To have some hot dish, a little coffee hour, right? A little chit chat, and just kind of, you know, relax on Sunday morning a little bit. You know, gear yourself up for a long day of football with a nice couple of prayers. Okay. So I take from Coates' words a warning about thinking about the church too strongly in terms of as a place of refuge. Again, not to say that it's a place where people should be harmed and abused and that sort of thing, but just notice who is getting refuge. Why are we retreating to the church?
And then the church is also that gives refuge to immigrants or people that are threatened to the dreamer thing, that they are threatened to be deported.
Yeah, sanctuary churches and things.
Yeah, so that I think should very well be a role of the church to give those people a place to see the thing.
Right. Yes, exactly. So I'm not saying we abandon the idea of the church as a refuge. I'm just sort of trying to press or
the fact my cat doesn't need refuge.
Yes, maybe. That's why I think of my church.
Well, right, I would say that what she's talking about is that oftentimes the idea to make you feel good.
Yeah. Right.
So we're doing our part, we're okay.
Right.
Rather than taking more responsibility.
Right. Right. So you might think, I've had a really hard week at the office, and the church is the place where I go to kind of unwind, to relax, to be amongst friends, right? And I think Coates would see that as a retreat, right? Whereas when you're thinking of refuge as a place, or the church as a sanctuary, again, for those who have been oppressed, or those who are facing all kinds of struggles, that language might be different than the way Coates is using it here. But my suspicion is, and again, you can agree or disagree, and I'm curious to hear where you are, is that often we use the language of the church as refuge, or the church as a place of rest or welcome. We're a welcoming church. You see that printed on church signs all the time, right? We use that language uncritically. Right? We don't ask who's being welcomed, who's being offered refuge, what are we hiding from? Are you hiding from people who are victimizing you? Are you hiding from your own identity as a victimizer? Right? So again, why does Coates think this? Because he has no sense that any just God is on his side. So how would he think that a just God is on his side?
There might be a little more equity in his world.
Okay. So if he saw more equity in his world? Good, good, good.
Few Others? White policemen looking over his shoulder.
What's that?
Fewer white policemen daily, mm-hmm. hourly, looking over his and his people's shoulders.
Yes. So less surveillance by police, white and otherwise. Some brown and black cops sort of get sucked into the police culture as well. But yes, less police surveillance, less cops looking over your shoulder. What else?
Is the body of God's people we're working with him and helping to alleviate some of that unjustness?
So if the people who were arguing there should be less cops and more equity were self-identified and proudly Christian in those battles, I imagine it would be harder or more difficult for Coates to figure out what to do with Christians. Right? But because most of the images of Christians he gets are ones who retreat into sort of piety or personal spirituality, it's easy to say, well, that's what Christians are about. Right? Not to say that there aren't Christians out there that are doing that kind of work, but there probably are a lot fewer, no, not probably, there are a lot fewer than we need, and they make a lot less noise. This has always been one of my challenges about being a Lutheran. I signed up intentionally, so I have no excuse. I joined the Lutheran Church in college, so I wasn't like snookered in at birth or something. But over the years of being a Lutheran, I came to discover sort of piecemeal, bit by bit, all of the great things that like Lutheran Social Services does. And I was like, I've never heard of any of this, right? Like maybe tangentially and occasionally in church on like, don't forget to give money to LSS Sunday. But I haven't seen the Lutherans in the news, right? I haven't seen y'all like marching or like doing big efforts, disruptive efforts, right? So again, it may not even be the fact that, it may mean more than we realize to be a visible presence. It's not just enough to kind of work behind the scenes. That as long as you're working behind the scenes, that allows other messages about Christianity, about religion, to kind of dominate. And when we're not getting airtime for those kinds of actions, we need to challenge those who are in control of the airwaves and say, why are you only cranking out sort of these negative stories or focusing on one slice of Christianity as being the defining mark of Christianity?
It's not only that. I think we also think it would be arrogant to self-satisfying that.
Yes.
If you advertise that and don't realize that it might also be part of a good message that you might want to have out there. You don't talk about that.
Right? Yeah. So a kind of fear of arrogance, you're saying,
yeah.
Talking about yourself, about saying you're great at anything, right? So what language would Thomas Aquinas use for that? There you go. You're the P word. Pusillanimous. That's easier to say, I think. Pusillanimous. Right, so we're being weak. That's not really humility, right? That's more fear, an excessive fear of being seen to do anything. My little nugget of advice for this is exactly right. My little nugget of advice as a Luther scholar is to think of it this way, though. So Luther was really against works righteousness, for those of you who don't know. He hates this idea that you would ever try and like show or prove that you're earning God's love. It's not a thing that you earn. God simply gives it, and you receive it gratefully. And even that is an act of God itself. It gets really complicated. It's a very circular, we'll talk more later. But anyway, all of it's God all the way down. We'll leave it at that. And so, yes, this idea then of talking about your virtues and talking about the good things you do and your work for justice is really off-putting if you've been honed and trained in this tradition that tells you it's all God all the time. But what's interesting is that Luther will constantly say great things about the works of other people, right? And he thinks you should do this. So it's a subtle but important difference, right? It might feel weird to say, I'm doing these great things, I'm wonderful. If that feels weird to you, then just do it about the person sitting next to you, right? Tell folks about all the great things that your neighbor is doing, about how she opened this great home to 103 children into foster care, and about how, all these things have happened. Right? So share the stories about other people, and eventually somebody will share a story about you, hopefully, right? If you've listened to all this week. And we can maybe get around that fear that way. Yeah? It's a clever workaround. All right, a couple more things. From Coates on religion. Coates is also a little bit worried about our remembering of black heroes like Martin Luther King Jr. and the kind of black people we lift up today, right? So this is him commenting on his time as a child, sort of, during Black History Month and all these other kinds of things where suddenly a bunch of black faces are shown. And he says this, "The black people in these films seem to love the worst things in life. Love the dogs that rent their children apart, the tear gas that clotted their lungs, the fire hoses that tore off their clothes and tumbled them into the streets. They seem to love the men who raped them, the women who cursed them, love the children who spat on them, the terrorists that bombed them. Why are they showing this to us? Why were only our heroes nonviolent? I speak not of the morality of nonviolence, but of the sense that blacks are in a special need of this morality." Okay? Notice, he's carefully choosing his words. Right? He's not saying, I'm pro-violence. But he's like, why is society so excited to show us non-violent black heroes? Right? Or in the documentary that I mentioned about Baldwin, there's this nice depiction of a Sidney Poitier movie I'd never seen. I've seen a few of them, but I haven't seen this one. But it's like Sidney Poitier is a black convict, and there's a white convict with him, and they're escaping from prison. And, they don't get along. Like, the white guy's a racist. It's this, awkward buddy comedy sort of thing. So they don't get along. The white guys are racist. They're selling the lamb together. But there's this one scene where Sidney Poitier's character, the black character, is on the train, and the white guy's running alongside, and he can't make it. Like, his leg is hurt, and he can't jump on. And so Sidney Poitier jumps off the train to be with him and kind of stick it out. What's that? And Baldwin comments on this and sort of saying, like, all the white people are cheering, and all the black people are like, what are you doing, Sidney? Right? Leave him. Stay on the train, you fool. Right? Not because they're against neighbor love and concerns the other and all that sort of thing, but there's a certain message being conveyed here about the need of the black man to kind of lower himself. And look how good he is, because he's stooped down to help the white man. And again, just the images that are shown about who counts as a black hero and who doesn't. The way that Malcolm and Martin are pitted against each other. Yeah. Right? So again, just paying closer attention to, even when we think we're doing something good and trying to highlight the civil rights movement, right? What pieces of it are we highlighting? And what kind of images and what kind of frameworks is that creating for how we view, say, Black Lives Matter? I've heard many people sort of say, you know, this movement is so violent today, but it wasn't like it was back when King was marching. I've heard that sentence many times out of the lips of people looking at me saying it seriously, right? And maybe you're thinking that yourself, right? As you watch the news, as you see, you know, the SWAT team lined up in the tanks, the paramilitary operation of the police these days, lined up against all these crowds who are blocking the freeway, you think, oh, this is so disruptive, right? Well, you only think that because you've only seen Martin Luther King on T-shirts, right? Okay? All right. Couple points. Oh, where'd I go? Too far. Oh, there we go. All right. So I'm going to end with a couple of questions here. So Coates is critical of Christians and the Christian church. I'm going to hear more from you. Do you agree or disagree with Coates' characterization? Do these criticisms resonate with your own experience? Yeah.
I think we've had a big thing in our church about this exact thing.
Okay.
Where the pastor wants to downgrade the idea of us being a harbor and a place of refuge and get out and get all the community in. Well, we've been so demeaned by all that talk that the old line church is gone. Mm-hmm. We were run away, so to speak. But to get the rest of the world coming in is an intentional thing that takes a congregation of people to work at it.
Mm-hmm.
If the congregation is so demeaned by being told that they're just seeking refuge and comfort and escape, you know, there is that element there. I go to mm-hmm. church to be with Christian people. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. So, anyway,
yeah.
We've been feeling it, and believe me, it's not an easy transition.
Okay. So, if I'm hearing you right, you felt that you and the congregation have been sort of accused
yeah.
in a way repeatedly that sort of has worn you down.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I would
Others?
Say ours is the opposite. It's... We try to raise these issues at our church and have a place where we can talk about it, because a big chunk of our congregation wants to talk about, on killing young black men and Black Lives Matter and all this stuff. And there's no safe. We're pushed back because of the. We want to keep this place a safe refuge for the comfortable conservative white people in our church, right? So. That really resonates with me.
I have a comment.
Yeah, so, John, Bob.
Being a white perpetrator is a difficult thing in the sense of trying to be compassionate. And the reason I think it is because I lack something that minorities have so intrinsically. Namely, I lack the suffering that you've gone through. And until I can begin to empathize with that suffering, not a whole lot's going to change. Because there's no motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in one sense, I'm envious and jealous of you because you've got that passion for the change. And I'm saying, how can I get that compassion? You know, or how can I get that motivation that will bind us together?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me the only way that can happen is living together. And until that happens, the systemic realities that exist will continue to perpetuate the same kind of suffering on you,
mm-hmm.
and still keep me comfortable. And so what I try to do, I live in a rural community of 5,000 people, is, well, we have one black person in town, but he passes through, you know, so it's not, and we have a couple of Spanish people, but they're clears. And it's difficult to get that connectedness so that the compassion changes the society.
Okay.
And that's, I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm just kind of curious what your comment would be about that. So.
For sure. So two things come to mind as I'm listening. The first is I don't know that I have intrinsically any better experience or understanding of suffering, just insofar as I don't know that any of this is like intrinsic or inherent or not. But certainly I'm going to have different experiences of suffering, and that different black and brown folks are going to have different experiences themselves. So part of the first step is to try and figure out what are the actual experiences of the actual people that I'm trying to engage with or be related to, and trying to give them some space and a chance to share their experiences. So I focused on, for example, Coates, who I think is giving us his experience of a black man in the United States, particularly a black man growing up in Baltimore in the 80s. And that's his experience. The experience of black and brown folks in your community might be very different. So part of the task is just to begin by creating spaces where white people don't talk and they listen to the folks who are around them. Okay, so that's my first thought. My second one is to sincerely agree with what you're saying about the need to feel the weight of suffering and to feel the connection, the personal connection. Right. For so many of these issues, I think in a lot of Lutheran circles in particular, because Lutherans all settled in very cold white places, that they sort of isolated themselves culturally because of immigration patterns, and then sort of repeated as they got absorbed into the larger project of whiteness in the United States. And so a lot of these can seem like distant problems if you don't feel like you have people of color in your community. That's fine. The question then you have to ask yourself is, why are there not people of color in my community or my church? And to not assume that it's simply a natural consequence of, you know, they want to live together in this community or that's just the way it is, to really interrogate what is it about my community and my lifestyle that are keeping us apart. Final thought I had. Sorry, I always have more thoughts. The final thought is you were speaking. There's often a desire to ask how we can bring people of color into our congregation. I think that's good and worthwhile, but I think it might also be the case that we don't need to bring people of color into our congregation. Maybe we need to find ways to support them wherever they are and what they're doing. So to make it less about membership or evangelism and make it more about just the broader mission as Christians in this society. And so in that case, it wouldn't be a challenge of like, oh, we only have one black person and two Latinos in our community, so I guess we'll try and get them to come to church or something like that. It'll be more about, you know, how can this white congregation, that's probably going to be white for a while, let's not kid ourselves, how are we going to partner with or listen to and find ways to give aid to other congregations? Through the use of our space, the use of our time and talents, how are we going to build organic relationships? Right. When I was in Metro New York, several of the black congregations in the black pastors group, they would take confirmation trips, and they would intentionally get buses with other white congregations. And the white congregations would help pay for the buses sometimes because they usually have a little more money. It's like, we're going to do these things together, and you're going to help us in the way that you can, and we're going to be present together for a while and let our children play and bond, and that's going to be a small but important first step. So keeping our aspirations more mundane and more focused on the needs of the other, and not being driven by our own fears about membership or that kind of stuff. Okay, so those are my three thoughts. We can talk more, and I'll think more about it.
I mean, it is really hard if you live in a community where you don't have other people there as well. and it's just like a mainly white community. But and it's hard to try and draw people in, like you said, to try and see the differences. But what you could do, potentially, is just be aware of your own privilege. And that's hard to do when you don't have anyone to like contrast yourself with. But the fact that you feel safe, the fact that no one looks at you funny or thinks of you as the other when you're just getting about your daily lives, the fact that you don't feel like you're being judged for every small thing that you might be doing, you know, you're just happily living, happily, passively enjoying your own little life. No one's putting too much pressure on you. No one's expecting any huge thing from you. And this is all part of the white privilege, you know, and just to be aware of your own like blessings. And it is hard to do when you don't have a contrast, but the fact that you live just peacefully, just be aware of that peace, because a lot of people don't live like that. And for us, that's something we could just dream of in a distant land, but it's not our reality, you know? So having these conversations is fantastic. And even if you never meet a black person or a Muslim or any or Hispanic, any minority group, just be aware of who you are, the hand of cards that you have. It's a great hand. Enjoy it. And you know, use that as a form of compassion for other people who have a really crappy hand, you know?
Well, for the most part of our lives, we've been married for 50 years, but for the most part of our lives, we have lived in predominantly black, Hispanic neighborhoods by choice. Mm-hmm. We've bought properties in those areas, and we've been in Oakland, California, we've been in Sierra Tidal area, in Portsmouth, Virginia, which is predominantly 70% black and 30% or 20% Hispanic. But we've chosen to live in those contexts so that we rub up and participate in the community in which we live. And it's, but now, in the last 3.5 years, we live in just enclave 5,000 people that are just rural Trumpites. It's disgusting. And all we do, we find ourselves trying to find subtle ways to change the mentality.
And I think that the fact that you're even thinking like this is so fantastic. And I don't mean to say like specifically to you, like you need to do this and you need to, but like, you know, all white people with white privilege. So it's not just specifically you.
My wife and I live in a deep sense of guilt. It's to be in this honor way of doing. And we come in this church, and so, you know, what I try to preach is not attitudes about black and white, but I try to preach examples of how people can become compassionate for other cultures, including Muslims, including, you know, all kinds of races. And so I use stories that just emotionally move the congregation to perhaps think differently and to embrace the sufferings of all people and all cultures throughout the world.
I'm going to toss in one comment just to add on to this great comments I'm hearing here. I think we're also maybe running into some of the limits of individual efforts of compassion and self-transformation. You're using the great example of you've been dealt a great hand, right? Well, again, you were dealt that hand by people controlling the cards and sort of stacking the deck. And so one of the reasons why the change is so slow and so difficult and so arduous is because it's not change you can affect individually. What are our congregations and communities doing to affect change politically, socially, structurally? Right? Yeah.
I'm from Northern Ireland,
yeah.
And during the 60s, when the civil rights, I don't mean to make any equivalency here, but in the 60s when the civil rights movement was happening here, there was a similar civil rights movement building on the back of what was happening here for Catholic community in Northern Ireland, which had for centuries been leaned on by Protestant community in Northern Ireland. That eventually led into the conflict we had then for 40 years. And there were always people reaching out across and trying to bring understanding and build bridges. One of the things that in addition to that, one of the movements that created, that broke the logjam in the late 80s when the violence looked like it was going to be uncontrollable, was a group of Protestants who, instead of saying, across the divide, tell us what it's like and help us understand, or instead of building those bridges, actually turned around to their own community and said, here is our complicity in what has happened.
Yeah.
And so that movement, at great risk, started. One of the great rallying cries for Protestant ascendancy in Northern Ireland was for God and Ulster, making this idea that God and our part of the nation had a particular relationship, and they were looking to destroy that. So that was the rallying cry. This group of Protestants in Northern Ireland took that phrase and said, what if it was not for God and Ulster, but for God and God's glory alone? That God made no, God had no preference about nationhood. And then we address all the great theological words like reconciliation and forgiveness and repentance. And we produced material on each of those words saying, this is not just about you and God, this is about you and your community, this is about you and your neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 80s and early 90s then, that in the face of real conflict from our own, that movement, I think historically academics are now saying that that was one of the key movements that broke the logjam that led to the peace process and eventually signed the peace agreement. But it was the capacity, not just relating across difference, it was also the capacity to tell the hard truths to our own community, of our own complicity, of our own poor theology, that catalyzed enough support within the Protestant community then to say, we've got to stop it. And I think that's an important dimension. It's not just about being guilt for how we have been complicit. It's about saying, here is our fault, here is our role, how do we change? So we need voices within the community, within the white community, telling us, rather, you know, than simply two sides arguing across
a body. That's wonderful. Yeah. That's one of the reasons why earlier in the week I slipped Amos in on you,
yeah,
right? And I highlighted the fact that Amos is this prophet who himself is rich and is speaking about the dangers of the wealth and the way that wealth can acquire in the north. There's this interesting power of someone in a community to speak to people of similar economic and other backgrounds to sort of catalyze. So this is excellent. Thank you very much. Sorry, next to you there was a hand, sorry.
I'd just be curious on what your take would be on Frederick Douglass and kind of his approach to codes.
Uh-huh.
Because Frederick Douglass, if I understand kind of correctly, talked about slavery as an institution, an institutional sin,
mm-hmm,
right, in which both the slave owner and the slave are kind of in this same, you know, kind of place in their suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Frederick Douglass was pretty radical in his letters about that.
Sure.
And Coates certainly seemed to have at least a different perspective on what you talked about. Maybe I'm just hearing it differently, but and Douglass certainly had a very different interpretation on religion and Christianity and its role, and I was kind of curious on, you know, the two kind of approaches that they took.
Yeah.
Obviously different time periods, but...
I mean, folks have said, and I think there probably maybe some truth to this, that Coates comes across much more pessimistic than Baldwin, than Douglass, and some other authors. But I think the reason that Coates doesn't make that same kind of move is, again, the fear of a phrase we've heard a couple times, of a false equivalency, or how quickly that can act to exonerate or exculpate white people and white actors. And so if you say, listen, you know, we're suffering too under the burdens of privilege, under the burdens of feeling superior, under the burdens of having to maintain the levers of economic power, a lot of that's really stressful. And I hear that in the church sometimes too, like everyone in our community is suffering in different ways, right? And so our people are suffering too, even if you don't see it. That's true, but in the way you're saying that, in the place you're saying that, you can also just be, again, generating this false equivalency and sort of dismissing any responsibility for dealing with these other sufferings of other people or responding to them. And so I think that, again, this is my reading on Coates, I think he has a similar fear about that, too quickly moving to the suffering or the souls of white folk, to borrow Du Bois's term, might miss what's happening to the souls of black folk. I'm getting two more comments. People haven't spoken yet today. Okay.
I want to come back to the question of church, because I think we have a lot of church leaders in this room. And I want to speak as someone that just turned 70 this week. And for basically 50 years, I had the privilege of hearing church leaders teach me about being with church in a way that is about liberation, that's radical, that... And I learned that from, I had the privilege of having pastors, campus ministers, people that I work with. And I'm saying that because it's very different, and I have not lived in communities of color. I live in Philadelphia, so that's not entirely true. But I would say for me, fundamentally, it had to do with from when I was, you know, probably just in my late teens, of learning what it meant to be the church. From people who were courageous and were standing on the, you know, I came of age and the anti-Vietnam time, you know, and campus ministry was out there. And so the challenge then is it's not only just about, you know, oh my God, I don't live with people of color, I don't have those relationships. It's those of us who are teaching children, who are teaching teenagers, who are preaching, you know, have to, you know, we're called to talk about the church in a way that this is what it means to be the church. No, we're not just a place of refuge. Yes, comfort for those who are grieving and all this, but we're called to be out there in society and to be voices of liberation. And I just want to say it's, you know, if we don't go, if we go that route, we can have a huge impact.
I love what you're putting on. You're making clear it's sort of a both and thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's not an either or. It's not we stop burying people and only march on
right.
Saturdays.
Right.
That there is time and space for both of those. And exactly. With one more hand back here, I'll give you the last word.
I just want to briefly bring up the idea of white fragility and how much of a thing that really is, that we really have been taught as part of the system that we are good people, and we are, but part of that is the not seeing, and as we approach it, I just think of it, because sometimes it's really hard to address this without causing people, each other, ourselves, to feel more the shame and the guilt and get caught in that. But just the idea that we can move through realizing we've been part of the system and not realizing it, and it wasn't intentional. But let's see the system for what it is and change the system and not focus so much on our own sense of guilt. That really is part of this idea of white fragility, which is kind of a hard concept to even hear, is a real thing because it's part of this what's kept the system in place. It's a very specific part of it. So just hearing that talk.
That's perfect. That's an excellent note to end on.
Yeah.
So I hope that after this week, people will be a little less fragile, right? Maybe one of the cures for white fragility will be a little bit of courage. As I said last night, I hope that each of you find some small way to be a little more courageous where you are. There's always a dangerous of mountaintop experiences, especially when they're literally on mountains, that you're like, yeah, this is all great, and then sort of like it drifts away as you ride the slow boat down the lake. And it just sort of falls into Lake Chelan, and then you're like down to the bottom, like, ooh, I feel good again. I hope you find some way to hold on to some small piece of this. I thank you for letting me be part of this week with you and sharing my reflections, my thoughts. I hope you explore some of the authors and thinkers we've laid out this week. And don't be afraid to keep in touch afterwards. You can Google me and find me on the interwebs. My name is Anthony Batiza. You've probably heard it a couple times. Google it. There's only like 5 Batizas in the world, so we're easy to find. I'm the only one in St. Olaf. Send me an email. I have 2 response times on email, either immediately or a really long time. Nothing in between. But please reach out. And I'd love to hear from you if you have follow-up questions, if you want to get the name of an author, want to run something past me. Don't be shy. I'll be at a computer again in a week or so. God bless. Take care.